This is the second of the four talks that I'm giving on aspects of going for refuge. And last week I focused on going for refuge itself, the more volitional aspect of things. And I used the image of Pacific navigators, wayfinders, to give a sense of the journey, the voyage we undertake when we go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And if you were here last week, you'll remember that these Pacific navigators, quite extraordinary, without any compass or sextant or any kind of navigational instruments, they were able to cross vast distances in the Pacific using an intimate awareness of the sun, the moon, the stars, the winds, the ocean currents, all the seabirds and fish. They just tuned in so deeply to those and were so well schooled in the meaning of them, that they could navigate across these vast distances. So I told that story last week to give a sense of this, that going for refuge is a kind of a journey, and to give us a little bit of a sense of some of the qualities that we need to make that journey to awakening. Including ongoing mindfulness and keeping a vision of the goal in mind. And then a real sensitivity to our experience, a real engagement with our experience, particularly conditionality. These wayfinders, they're just very, very sensitive to all the conditions arising moment by moment. I mentioned last week they stay awake for 22 hours a day very often to do this. And then there's also, we need an open-heartedness and care for those around us, because everyone on the boat depends on the wayfinder. And also a radical transformation in how we relate to our experience. So this week we're coming on to the knowing, understanding aspect of spiritual experience. So the development of wisdom, pranya, through which we gain insight into things as they really are, or how things really are. And doing this liberates us from suffering, from tension, from stress, because the root of that suffering is the friction between how we imagine or assume things to be and how they really are. Because we're working with a view of ourselves and the world that isn't in accord with how things are, we're constantly going against the grain of how things are, and that kind of friction is what we call dukkha, suffering. And this insight aspect of spiritual experience is crucial. And so it's vital that there's an element of it at every aspect of our practice, right from when we first begin the Dharma life right to the end of the path. So the voyage of going for refuge is a voyage of discovery. And on that voyage, we're all explorers. And our path to awakening has to be one in which we take nothing for granted, and during which we explore more and more deeply the whole wonder of human life, and especially the wonder of awareness and the deeper aspects of our mind. And one of the functions of a sangha, of a spiritual community, like, taking an example at random, the one around the Cambridge Buddhist Centre, one of the functions of a sangha is to be engaged in that exploration, that voyage of discovery together, sharing our understandings, helping one another to see through unhelpful and untrue narratives about ourselves and the world. So this evening we're going to look briefly at some of the, well, particularly some of the earlier stages of that voyage. And that voyage goes from right view to what Bhante calls perfect vision, direct knowing of how things are. And that journey involves a deepening process, going from listening to the Dharma, to reflecting on it, to meditating, to really becoming absorbed in it. So we open ourselves to the Dharma through hearing or reading or however we take it in. We make it our own through reflection. We really apply it to ourselves and our lives, and we test it out. So then we have right view. And then we take that understanding deep into our being until we know it viscerally, intuitively, until we embody that piece of truth. We become it, at which point we don't need to hold it in our heads. We just are it. That's naturally how we see the world. So, listening, reflecting, meditating. And when I talk about reflecting, unfortunately, people often will take that as something very rational, that it just means thinking about things. So you think about impermanence, for instance. But actually, reflecting is something which we do with all of ourselves. All our different faculties can be involved. So if we're thinking about impermanence, that's good. But if we really reflect on impermanence, then we use all of our experience. It's like we kind of ransack all of our life experience to really see whether that's true or not. So we can use memory, we use imagination, we use our intuition. Even our body is really involved. You know, it's like when you hit something and feel, yes, that's true, you can almost feel how you're something in your body, there's a sort of energy movement in your body. Yeah. If you're in a room with somebody and they say something that's really true, it's not just you think, oh yes, that's really true. It goes much deeper than that. You feel it very directly. So we're using all of ourselves to engage with the Dharma. And it's good if we do that with as few preconceptions as possible. If we can put down our assumptions, even our assumption that the Dharma is true, actually, really just to look as freshly as possible so that we're really convinced. And this whole process of reflection has to connect up different aspects of ourselves. Sangharakshita Bhante talks about how when you come along very often, when you start to meditate, you're not a very integrated kind of individual. You know, you're one person at work, you're a slightly different kind of person with your family, or another person doing this situation and that situation. And you've also taken in all kinds of ideas and views of life through your conditioning. And they're all kind of in there, and different ones kind of pop out at different times. So he says that rather than being, you know, one kind of integrated self, so to speak, we are more like a bundle of selves loosely tied together with a named address. Doesn't beat about the bush, Bhante. So that also means that we're a bundle of views loosely tied together. And we can notice how in different situations different views come to the fore. So part of us is trying to practice the Dharma, believes that, you know, everyone can do it. But then there's another voice in there which goes something like, everyone else can do this, but I can't, for instance. Or last week, the week before last, I was leading a retreat, and somebody told me they discovered this voice which said something along the lines of, well, the Dharma's all very good, but basically it's a fantasy. It's just a way of making life, which is really quite hard and difficult, palatable. Yeah, you just imagine all this lovely stuff and it makes things all right. And often what happens is that we, in our better moments, when we're not identified with those voices and believing them, when we have more of a Dharma perspective, they kind of come up and we just kind of push them away and go, no. But when we do that, that's fine if we've really seen through them, if they're just like old ghosts of old selves, ghosts of things which we believed when we were 17, ghosts of things which we believed at this point in our, or some point in our lives. If we've really seen through them, that's fine. But actually, quite a lot of these views, they kind of carry on a kind of existence in parallel with us. So some of the time we don't believe them, and some of the time we do. So if there are these kind of recurring views which aren't in line with the Dharma, we really need, at some point, to get them out into the open and give them a lot of space and really check them out, really go into them. Now, is that really true? Because otherwise, it's as if we're trying to go along the path with these sort of things dragging on us, sort of sapping our energy. Yeah. It's like, on your voyage to awakening, there's these views which kind of actually make little holes in the bottom of the boat. So there you are, sort of trying to make progress, but the boat is starting to sort of slowly fill with water. And you kind of notice that, but you may just kind of bail for a bit and then go back to sort of trying to sail. And you never really fix the boat. You never really kind of challenge those other views that you hold. And so you never get enough of your energy behind the Dharma for things to really go places. So, yeah, if we find that we're telling ourselves things that really aren't helpful or that aren't in line with the Dharma, then let's get them out into the light of day and really try and resolve them. Yeah. And see, are they right? I mean, is it true that everyone else can practice, but of course I never ever get anywhere? In which case it would be good to know that, because then we wouldn't waste our time, you know, trying to practice. We could go and, you know, do something else with our lives. Or is that not true? So we could let that voice that says that be in dialogue with the Buddha. Yeah. So what does the Buddha have to say in response to that voice which says, I can't do it? Lord, what does he say? Yeah. What do all those people who've practiced seriously over the last 2,500 years say? Maybe they say, what makes you think you're so special that the Dharma won't work for you? whatever they say, yeah, you bring that as it were unintegrated aspect into the practice and you resolve it. And it's really important that we do this because in a way our going for refuge will only be as good as our view of life. Otherwise we'll be putting lots of energy in, but the whole thing is limited by what we're telling ourselves. Yeah. So we have to really look. And this aspect of things... It's not so much there are kind of views that we take on, at least temporarily as we practice, but quite a lot of this aspect of the path is about deconstructing things. It's about taking apart the views that limit us, the views that hold us back. Sometimes when you're doing this, if you do it in meditation, it can feel a bit like knocking down walls. There's a certain kind of energy that's really freeing you, that's really kind of not going to be limited by seeing things like this, and which really wants to know and understand. It can be very liberating. So we go from... reflection, which certainly involves thinking, but as I say, isn't limited to it. It's a process where we attend with the whole of ourselves. And we go into meditation. And often the forms of meditation, some of those are still more reflective, but there's more absorption, there's more concentrated energy behind those reflections, and then some of them cease to be conceptual at all, cease to be reflective. And most of us need to practice in both those ways. We need to be really reflecting, getting more and more energy behind right view, cutting through with a sword of wisdom those ways of looking at the world which hamper us, which limit us, which constrain us. And we also need to be trying to get underneath all our views, whatever they are, to see directly what is experience before we tell ourselves a story about it. So meditation involves both of those. And reflection can be a jumping off point for that kind of direct experience. It's like a couple of years ago I had a conversation with Sangharakshita where we were talking about the six element practice, which is a way of seeing through, being identified with the physical body, and then with emotions and ideas. And I was saying to Bhante, well, that's a series of reflections. And he was saying, yes, it's a series of reflections, but it leads to an experience. It leads to an experience beyond the rational conceptual level. Yeah. We start off using concepts, but then something else comes in. And sometimes if you're reflecting, say you're reflecting on impermanence, which isn't just that everything comes to an end, impermanence is also that every moment there's a new beginning, so to speak. Yeah, so you can be reflecting on impermanence, and at a certain point, it's as if it just drops onto a deeper level. It's as if you, as if it's, oh right, that's really true, or something about it really hits you. And when that happens, you don't need to keep thinking. Yeah? You just stay on that deeper level for as long as it lasts. Just stay with that experience of a deeper knowing, a deeper, more intuitive knowing. So we use within Sri Ratna various meditation methods to help us move from wrong view to right view, and from right view into perfect vision, which is direct knowing, direct seeing, direct intuitive knowing. And there's a range of different practices. There's the six-element practice, as I've mentioned. There's reflection on the three marks of conditioned existence, so looking at impermanence, looking at the unsatisfactoriness of holding on to experience, being identified with it, encouraging us to let go, and there's looking into no self, that sense that we have of being a fixed, separate me in here somewhere, confronted by an outside world of everything that is other. All that, we look into that and gradually see, or suddenly see, well, that's not how things are. So there are various practices like that. There's also sadhana, the visualization and mantra recitation of a Buddha or Bodhisattva, which also has a very strong insight element to it. It's a kind of a dramatized enactment of how things really are, because everything in the practice appears and is made of, it's made of light. So it becomes clear that certainly everything appears, but there's nothing that you can hold on to. There's nothing that you can ever finally kind of grasp onto. And then that figure, that Buddha, whatever it may be, dissolves away like a rainbow. And through repeatedly practicing in that way, you begin to see things in that way. You realize that it's not just, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in your imagination that are like that. Rooms full of people are also like that. Yeah. Everything is like that. And the practice accustoms you to that vision. If you do it day after day, it goes deeper and deeper. And all these practices and any insight practice is about, actually isn't terribly interested in the content of the experience. From the insight point of view, what we're interested in is the nature of whatever's appearing. So rather than, you know, if I'm sitting here taking you in, I'm thinking, oh, there's so-and-so, there's so-and-so, here we are in the theatre. If I'm looking at things from an insight point of view, then I'm not so concerned about the content. I'm just aware that moment by moment, things are changing. Somebody's just leant forward a little bit, now somebody's writing a note. There's constant change. Nothing about the experience is static. And if I were to try to somehow fix this experience and hold on to it, however I tried, I never could. You know, at a certain point, you're all going to get up and walk out, hopefully not before I finish talking to you, but you never know. Yeah. And this assembly will change when the conditions that have brought us all together have finished. So then I'd be focusing on the nature of the experience. Those are one or two aspects of the nature of the experience. I could focus on others as well. But you get the idea. It's the content isn't so important. It's the we're trying to understand what's true of all our experience. And what's great about that is that we can do that any moment of our lives. Because the nature of our experience is always the same. The nature of our experience is always flowing. It's always ungraspable. There's nothing we can finally get hold of, however much we might want to try. And we find that whenever we do try and grasp onto it, there's always tension. Because we're working on an assumption that's not taking into account how things really are, which is that everything's flow. So at any moment, we can be noticing, exploring, taking an interest in those qualities that are always there in experience. So everything is arising in dependence on conditions. And we can notice that. And that's true externally, and it's true internally of our emotions, our thinking, and so on. Which also means that we can set up conditions so that what arises can be more and more satisfying, more and more fulfilling. So if we keep on exploring the nature of our experience from wherever we start, and we may start very, very simple, and gradually build this up, because for most of us to go into it deeply, we need a foundation. We need particularly what Bhante calls a reservoir of positive emotion. Otherwise, very often our previous conditioning and our negative emotions get hold of this stuff, and then we take things the wrong way, we take impermanence the wrong way, and think everything comes to an end. And we sort of spiral downwards with it, rather than feeling everything flows, everything is constantly fresh and new, which allows for constant creativity, for instance. So we need to set up conditions to be able to work with this stuff deeply. But we can always start with something, because, life doesn't wait, until we're completely ready for things to happen. It's like we can't go, please, nobody close to me die until I've developed a reservoir of positive emotion in however many years that will take me. So we need to be accustoming ourselves to the fact that, okay, things do change, and holding on to things doesn't work. Learning to kind of let go, learning to give our experience its freedom, and trusting that if we do that, life will become more and more fulfilling, and we'll become freer and freer. So if we keep on doing this, from whatever point we start at, eventually we will see directly how things are, which is called opening the Dharma eye in the tradition, and it's also referred to as stream entry, where we, in our, if you like, in our voyage of discovery, there comes a point where the prevailing winds and the currents are in your favour, so you will be carried along. Yeah, it's like the momentum of practice and the momentum of understanding has grown so great that it's just going to keep on unfolding. And you see examples of that, for instance, in the Pali Canon, where someone talks to the Buddha and the Buddha answers them, and right at that moment, it's as if the scales fall from their eyes and they see how things are. The true spotless vision of the Dharma arises in them, as it's put. Which makes it sound as if that kind of experience is always a sudden experience. But it seems as if we're all very different as human beings. We're different in our psychophysical, psycho-spiritual makeup. Yeah. So some people have quite dramatic kind of Dharma lives, with big ups and sometimes big downs, and more big ups and sudden seeings, and all very dramatic. Other people, it doesn't seem like much is happening at all. It's just steady, day after day, you know, a bit more ethical practice, a bit more meditation, and so on. Yeah. And Bhante uses a couple of analogies which sort of bring this out. One is, he talks about insight being like a flash of lightning, where suddenly you see, oh, that's how things are, this is how things are. And then after a while there's another flash of lightning, and then a bit quicker another flash of lightning, and then until eventually, rather than just having a moment where things are illuminated, the flashes of lightning, as it were, start to join up. So you start just seeing more, you know, for longer periods of time. This is how things are. So that's one model, which is the kind of sudden one. But then he has another one where you have a pair of scales, and one side is definitely weighs more than the other, but you start pouring sand into the lighter one, and gradually the scales come to a balance, and then with just one more grain of sand, the lighter one is now the heavier one. But you don't see that point. You can't tell that point. It's only when you've gone, the scales have gone quite a long way past the tipping point, that you know, oh, okay, it's like the things have shifted. So either of those could be how things are. And Lama Tilman, the man who guided the 3+ year retreat that I did in France, he'd guided a lot of people in retreats over many years. And he said, in his rough estimation, about 50% of people would have some kind of quite definite experience where they could say, ah, oh, right, that's it, now I've seen something. And the other 50% didn't. It was just, there was a steady, continuing practice, and over the years, it's as if everything came more and more into focus and got clearer, but there was no moment or nothing dramatic at all, nothing you could point at. So it's important that we realise that we're different in this respect. And it's also important that we realise that there are degrees of depth of seeing into how things are, and we can see into one aspect of how things are without necessarily seeing fully. So you have quite partial seeings. Because sometimes, yeah, talking about stream entry, it sounds like, well, it's all done and dusted, just, you know, today, bang, now you've seen it. But often it's now you see it and now you don't, because you see something and your that does have an impact on you, which lasts for a little while, but then there's a tendency to for old ways of seeing to reassert themselves. So we have to keep on looking and looking, even at the things where we think, oh yes, I understand that. It's always possible to go deeper. And the best way to look is really freshly, as if we really haven't understood. So it's like, rather than me going, oh yes, look, everything's impermanent, I know that, and oh look, now you know, there's so-and-so moving in this way, and that's happening, so yes, that proves everything's impermanent. In a way, that doesn't go very deep, because what I'm doing is I'm taking a memory of something that I saw back there somewhere, and bringing it into the present moment, and just confirming what I knew. What's much more effective is to go, what are things like? Wow, look. There's movement there, that, and there. And actually, wherever I look, internally, I can feel the movement of the blood in my arm. Yeah, nothing's still, everything's flowing. And so you kind of discover it afresh. And that's much more effective than here's one I prepared earlier. Sort of wheeling out that insight again. And so when we come on to levels where we feel like we have seen something, we have to be aware of the kind of pitfalls that can come up. So one pitfall is that, in a way, the major pitfall is that we become, you know, here we are, we've been struggling to understand how things were, and now we've understood. So we really like to be the one who knows. That's such a nice position to be in, being the one who knows. And so we get very attached to being the one who knows. So we can keep confirming that we know, because we keep bringing our conceptual understanding of what we saw back there somewhere into the present moment. But actually, all that we're really confirming is that we're the one who knows. And if our insight was partly into no self, that there is no one who knows, then we're actually getting further away from what we saw rather than closer to it. So it's easy to do a sort of spiritual bypassing, as it's called, at higher levels, where you almost stop, you stop noticing where you don't really know, and you don't really look into things, because you're now attached to being the one who knows. So yeah, we need to keep on looking as freshly as we can, again and again and again and again. Open to the possibility that life might really surprise us. Maybe we discover this time when I look, maybe it isn't flowing. Maybe there's something permanent. No, it doesn't seem to be, but you know, I need to be open to that possibility, otherwise I'm not really looking. I'm just confirming an idea. And we also need to be careful about sort of holding on to insight as a kind of status. And that's more likely to happen if we've made some sort of statement about where we are on the path, particularly publicly. So if we say, you know, whatever, I'm a stream entrant, that has various difficulties to it. One is that different traditions mean different things by that. Over 2,500 years, you know, things have got defined in different ways. So we may not even know what we mean when we say that. Secondly, that in itself isn't very close to the actual experience. So we're much better off if we're talking about insight in appropriate conditions with people who will be able to relate to us. Yeah, we can talk about, oh, I had this experience. You know, there I was in the Cambridge Buddhist Centre, and I looked all around the room, and I could see, yes, you know, this, everything just flows. So I don't need to sort of turn that into some sort of attainment or, you know, grade, or give myself a Dharma black belt for being able to do that. You know, it's enough that I just say, oh, okay, in that moment, that's how things were for me. Because that's nearer to the truth. It's nearer to how things are. And it also helps prevent the danger that I start parading around with my Dharma black belt, feeling very kind of, you know, like I'm one who knows. Because, yeah, I will just cause myself suffering doing that. Because actually, there is just a flow of experience, and we won't find that one who knows. And even if we get to where we've had some kind of direct experience of things, that doesn't mean that there can't be further storms and difficulties. It just means that the prevailing winds and currents will eventually kind of carry us along. But they may carry us into, yeah, sometimes difficult areas. Again, I saw Bhante a few weeks ago, and then he was talking about his poetry, but from there we got on to him saying, people don't realise how deep the kleshas, the mental poisons of craving and aversion and so on, how deep they go. He said, people think, oh, it'd be quite easy to get through them. And having spent over 3 years, you know, sitting in a wooden circus wagon in France with my own mind, I could only agree with him. Yeah, we don't want to underestimate what we're up against. And if we do really see into how things are, then we take apart some of the stories and some of the, as it were, the ego structure. And when we do that, sometimes those emotions can come up very strongly. Yeah, it's as if they're not being held at bay, sort of more below the surface, by our strong sense of this is me and I'm like that. And of course, I'm not the sort of person who experiences that kind of negative emotion. So sometimes you get these kind of little explosions. But they're usually very sort of short-lived because we're not relating them back to a whole narrative about who we are and what we're like. So it's just like there's a moment of pow, bang, and then they sort of tend to disappear again. So the path carries on, and as we go further and deeper, that what was a partial insight will become a more natural way of seeing, and it will become fuller and deeper. What are we doing for time? Let's jump over one or two things. So we can see into impermanence, into the flowing nature of things. We can see that there's no fixed me, so somehow at the middle of our experience. But still we can sometimes have a sense of a separation. There's that sense of me kind of hangs around, in the sense that there's still a sense of subject and object. There's still a sense of me here, everything else out there separate. And the insight process needs to go deeper and deeper so that that starts to disappear. Not that it was ever there really in the first place. It's just that we're putting another view, another concept onto our experience, so that we interpret experience in terms of being separate, which is a very deep level of unsatisfactoriness, that sense of kind of existential isolation. But as time goes on, even that can go, so that there's a sense of coming home. Journey's end is, I guess, with full and complete enlightenment, but certainly a very significant landmark on the way is where that sense of separation disappears, where it's no longer experienced, where that subject-object dichotomy isn't needed. So I'm talking about letting go of self and letting go of the subject and the object, but when you get into this sort of territory, you end up very often with a kind of koan, a kind of paradox. Here you are, it's like somewhere just out there is this great open space of freedom, where there's no experiencing in terms of self, and you want to somehow kind of throw yourself into it. But how do you do that? Because every time you take a step in that direction, it's me trying to attain no self. Me, the subject, trying to go beyond the subject-object duality, which is immediately doesn't work. So you think, all right, well, that I'll give that up. So I just won't make any effort. But then what tends to happen is that your usual kind of patterns, they just carry on. So you're kind of stuck. You know, sort of, it doesn't work to make an effort out of a sense of me. And it doesn't work if me just goes, all right, then universe, go on, you do it. And yet somehow it happens. But it's a point which a lot of practitioners come to. They're kind of on the edge of something profound, trying to work out a way of throwing themselves over. But that doesn't do it. So in a way, all you can do is really go for refuge in the sense of invoking the deepest forces of the Dharma. Relax as much as possible. Have a light touch with the whole thing, because at this point very often you're trying so hard to work out how to take that step that just disturbs the whole thing. You need to have a light touch, realizing that actually nothing will really change, because there is no self to lose. And we need to really engage with our experience as it is here now, and do our best to let go of all the expectations, the hopes and fears about what might happen next moment, what might happen, will it happen, won't it happen. We just drop all that and relax into this moment now. And mysteriously, magically, we shall find ourselves in that open space. So I called this talk The Empty Boat. But the boat, of course, isn't literally empty. It's not like the Mary Celeste, you know, that boat which was found abandoned with all its crew missing. Or I wrote in a book called Tales of Freedom, I told the story of a man called Donald Crowhurst, sort of lone sailor, whose boat was found abandoned with no sign of him in the Atlantic. So it's not that when we gain insight into no self or emptiness of inherent existence, anything disappears. Oops. So the boat is empty. Just in the sense that everything and everyone has no inherent existence. There's nothing fixed about any of our experience. And although we'd really like to kind of find something to relate to as fixed, the fact that nothing is what makes the whole journey of discovery possible. It's what makes the whole path to enlightenment possible. It's why we can completely transform ourselves. So in that sense, it doesn't matter so much where we're starting from, because whatever we feel we're like now, there's nothing about that that can't be transformed. Everything about us can transform in more and more fulfilling ways. So when we do explore our experience, we never find any fixed entity, thank goodness. So on the voyage of discovery, we don't find a boat in the sense that anything that we can get hold of, the boat is just a collection of bits of wood and so forth, isn't it? We don't find a wayfinder. On our journey of discovery, we don't find, in meditation say, we don't find a meditator. We don't find a me that gains stream entry and who's then the one who knows. We don't find a subject, we don't find an object, which means that we're not separate, finally, from the rest of life. We're part of life. And we discover that to our great relief. So what we do find is just a flowing unfolding. Without a sense of a separate self to worry about, to defend and protect against a separate outside world. And without that, we discover a new sense, a new energy, a new freedom, a new creativity and spontaneity, because we're not stuck in any old pattern which is all based on a sense of I'm like this, I'll always be like this. All that goes. And also we discover a new depth of loving care for all experience, because we realise that we aren't separate from all our experience, all those beings around. And it's that aspect which takes us into love and compassion. And that's the aspect that we'll explore next week, when we'll have a talk called Ferrying Across.